Today on Rocking the Suburbs.
It's like a rock song book.
Hello, everybody. My name is Patrick Foster. You are listening to the Rock in the Suburbs podcast. And on behalf of my co-founder, co-host, and good friend, Jim Linehan, I want to welcome you guys to another episode. This is part two of a series that we're doing with a guy who's kind of become known for taking some dives into areas of artists' careers that you might not expect. So welcome, Scott Parks.
Hey, thanks. I'm glad to be back.
Glad to have you, and it was a really good conversation yesterday, and I'm looking forward to talking about these other ones. You mentioned, Scott, yesterday that there are some other areas where we dove in. I just want to mention those really briefly in case nobody heard yesterday, but if you didn't, you need to go back and listen to it. We talked about the Kinks at one point.
That's right. Yep, twice. We did the Kinks twice. Yeah, we did the Arista years, and you and I had, there was a three-episode arc on the RCA years.
The showbiz years, yeah.
that turned out pretty well. And then Neil Young in the 80s, which is, again, what kind of triggered me to start thinking about doing this, because I can't remember who it was. Someone mentioned you should do Lou Reed in the 80s, so.
That's probably the one that runs, you know, semi-parallel to that, so.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Why we'll get to that later. There's one album in particular in these next three that came out the same year, and I think has the same issues that the other album from Neil Young has. So
yesterday we talked about the first three albums that Lou Reed put out in the 80s: "Grown Up in Public," "The Blue Mask," and "Legendary Hearts." And "Legendary Hearts" came out in 83, and then by 84, Lou had almost, in some ways, kind of reinvented himself a little bit again, right?
Exactly.
He put out a record called New Sensations.
That's right, yeah. And unlike the last two albums, Legendary Hearts and The Blue Mask, were literally Lou and a bass player and a guitar player and a drummer.
Yep.
If you look at the liner notes of New Sensations, there are 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 13 people credited on this album.
Yeah.
A whole bunch of different instruments. There's a piano, synthesizers, accordion, electric violin, tenor sax, trumpets, trombones, four backing vocalists. So you're going to definitely get a different sound. And, you know, again, coming out in 1984, you might think that Lou would have kind of gone the way of Bruce Springsteen with Born in the USA, where it's kind of like a lot of synthesizer forward and whatever. But I honestly don't hear that on this one.
Yeah.
Robert Quine obviously left. There was a falling out, due to his lack of really being on Legendary Hearts that much.
Mm-hmm.
Even though they did tour for that Live in Italy album you were talking about, so Robert Quine left, and that left Lou basically to play all the guitar parts. So, unlike The Blue Mask, there are a ton of overdubs on this.
There
because
are.
He overdubbed his own rhythm guitar onto the songs that he played lead on.
Uh-huh.
So, or vice versa, one or the other.
Right.
One. So, tons of differences between the production style, and then the sound of this album is like probably the happiest sounding Lou Reed album that you can imagine. I mean, it kicks off with a song called "I Love You, Suzanne," which is almost like a 50s, 60s bebop. But I love it. It's great.
It is great.
I think it actually had some decent airplay on MTV. He made a video for it.
You broke my heart and you made me cry. You said I couldn't dance. And now I'm back to let you know that I can really make romance. You do what you gotta do. You do everything you can. You do what you wanna do. Hey, but I love you, Suzanne. You do anything once. You try anything twice. You do what you gotta do. Hey, but I love you, Suzanne. Hey, hey. Do what you Suzanne. I love you when you're good, babe. I love you when you're bad. You do what you gotta do, babe. But I love you, Suzanne.
And literally, the song starts off, "You broke my heart and made me cry. You said that I couldn't dance, but now I'm back to let you know that I can really make romance." I mean, that is like a Dion and the Belmonts.
Exactly. That is the 1950s personified right there, lyrics-wise. But and it just keeps on going. Like, it's just a really happy-sounding album. Maybe some of the songs aren't necessarily, like, happy in content, but for the most part, they really are. So after I Love You, Suzanne, I really, really love Endlessly Jealous as well.
Great
song.
Endlessly
Jealous is a great, great song. And then that goes into we're kind of getting to the time where I think almost every album has a throwaway track, and it's one of the singles, and that is My Red Joystick. But it's a fun listen.
It is a funny song. Yeah,
I really enjoy that song.
I don't want to call it a conceit, but it's a method of songwriting that was used in the 50s, right? There were a lot of songs that kind of went like that as well. I mean, you think of some Chuck Berry songs and things like that, you know? So it is kind of in a grand tradition in some ways. But, I remember that this is the first Lou solo album I ever bought. And I remember this really clearly. It was... it had to be 84, but there was a small chain of record stores around this area. And I don't know if anybody out there, Bill Mulligan or anybody who lives in the Northern Virginia area, remembers this record chain called Penguin Feather. Penguin Feather was a record store, although I think most of their product sales came from a little room they had in the back of each store behind a curtain. And you had to be 18 to go inside that room, and any of the things you bought in there you had to use only for smoking tobacco, of course, and you had to sign a little slip of paper. But they did have a little head shop in the back of those stores. But they used to have once a month Midnight Madness, and at midnight they would put a lot of their records on sale, especially the new ones. And I remember staying up, going with a friend, and buying New Sensations and Reckoning by R.E.M., those two.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was a very memorable kind of a night. But I love New Sensations as well. And you know, just the song, the title track even, New Sensations, starts off with, like, talking about how he got arrested on, you know, Christmas Eve. And he's got this whole different kind of a outlook. And he's just getting off on riding a motorcycle, you know, through the mountains and stopping off for a Coke. You know, it's kind of incredible.
And Coke.
Yeah,
exactly. And he, like, attends somebody's wedding and goes and puts a hillbilly song on the jukebox.
Yeah.
And it's just a totally different Lou than you've ever seen before. There's not any, there's really not any, like, you know, obviously drug songs, because he's I guess there is one, High in the City. He's, you know, been clean and sober now for 3 years or so. And you can just hear the difference and kind of feel the difference. It's a lot lighter of an album than even Legendary Hearts, which Legendary Hearts was still lighter than The Blue Mask.
Yeah.
And you talk about New Sensations, Fernando Saunders, he just absolutely kills it on that with his bass playing.
Ooh, new
I can picture in my head Lou riding his motorcycle, which is again basically what the song is about, and that bass line that just continues through the entire song. You just kind of can like see him driving the motorcycle while listening to this and just bopping along. I don't know. He's an incredible bass player.
Totally agree. And that's one of the things too that I think attributes to that kind of, you know, that lightness, that freshness that comes across with this album. There are horns on the record at times, mm-hmm. too. There's some electric violin on a couple of tracks, and it does feel much more, I think, worked on and maybe produced a little bit than the other two, which is not a bad thing.
Several songs have like a choir backing vocals,
yeah.
You know, like what he had done back in the 70s with Walk on the Wild Side.
Right.
And you know, there's a lot of kind of throwbacks to older sounding music while also being at the time current, because there are synthesizers, but it's not overdone. It's not that typical 80s sounding,
right,
with slap bass and electronic drums and all of this stuff. It's just a very well produced, very well written, very well performed record, in my opinion. It's very enjoyable. It's definitely one that I go back to, again, even more than maybe some of the ones that came before.
Yeah.
'Cause it's easy to listen to. It's not hard. It's not work to listen to.
That's a great point. It really is. And maybe one of the most easily accessible of all the Lou Reed solo albums, for sure. And it's surprising, I think, when you look at it in retrospect, you know, that he did it when he did it. And like you said, avoided the trappings of the 80s. It wasn't like he was trying to suddenly, you know, I think Born in the USA example was a great example, right? That was at the absolute peak of the Born in the USA stuff. And he wasn't trying to do that. He was trying to do something much more simple and focused.
Right.
And I think that's great. And, you know, the whole thing just reminds me of like, what? You could walk into the arcade and see Lou Reed down there, like,
exactly,
you know, playing the video
games. Playing Robotron.
Hilarious. But,
yeah, I know, as I was doing some research, I know a lot of people love the song My Friend George,
yeah,
which I think is pretty good. And then, you know, the whole second half is kind of different. It's a little bit less up-tempo,
mm-hmm.
A little bit more, you know, downbeat. But the whole second half's pretty good. But My Friend George into High in the City, and then finishing off with Down to the Arcade, it's a nice way to end, you know, this nice record. High in the City is just basically talking about wanting to walk around the city, but it's kind of funny where he's like, watch out for that guy. I think I saw him last Saturday on the news or something like that.
Right.
And I can't remember what one of the other lyrics is, something about, I've got my knife and you've got your something. I can't remember what the lyrics are, but it's just kind of tongue in cheek, maybe, where he's, you know, wanting to walk around the city and be happy, but knowing that it's really not the safest of places to be.
Absolutely. And it prehints, presages a little bit, although in a different way, an album that he made near the end of the decade.
Correct. Yes.
But I'll say too, you know, we were talking about a couple of tracks that Lou made that were kind of prescient. And I think Fly Into the Sun is kind of one of those too, where he's like, yeah, man, at times it feels like, you know, everything's kind of coming apart. You know, the earth is going to split, but I'm not going to run from it. You know, it's just going to be my,
yeah,
moment to be like, here I go, you know. So it's kind of an interesting song, too.
Yeah, and that sentiment right there would maybe not have been what he was thinking back in the late 60s and early to mid 70s.
No.
He would have been the exact opposite of that. I'm not going to continue, you know, I don't want, you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah,
like,
absolutely.
It had a totally different sentiment.
Yeah, absolutely. It would have been absolutely different. And it's kind of interesting too that that it could be very relatable nowadays too. You know, you never know. So it's kind of amazing. And so I love this one too. I really do. And I think I think I have a fondness for it because I was the first one I bought, and I remember when I got it and all that, but I loved it immediately, and I always have, and it's never you know, not been one that I would pull out and play when I was playing Lou records. So
yeah, and this was another one I got for $2.50.
Oh, wow.
Beautiful. So I got Blue Mask and this, and then the next one that we're going to be talking about.
Wow.
Which the next one is the this is the one that you know, he might have fallen into the 80s trap.
Yeah.
It's probably my least favorite, and it is called Mistrial. Came out in 1986, so he had a two-year 2-year period between albums, so you can kind of start seeing, you know, a lot of times artists will start releasing albums, you know, further in between, and that's what happened here. So 1986 Mistrial, there was a quote, or at least in a review, that somebody said he should have named this Misfire instead of Mistrial. And I don't know if it, I would say it's that bad, but yeah, the production definitely suffers on this. It was produced by Lou and his bass player Fernando Saunders, and it's just very 80s.
It is very 80s. Yeah.
There's fewer people playing on this, but it, you know, I don't even know if there might be what, 3 songs that have actual drums, and the rest of it is all programmed drums.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's what really kind of hinders the album. I think if they would have done it the way they did New Sensations, I think the songs are there. The songs aren't all throwaways.
Nope.
And I'm not saying they're all as good as what was on New Sensations, but it's really the production that for me kind of brings this down several notches from the previous one.
I totally agree. I think that's really well said. It's just got kind of a sound that really feels dated when you go back and listen to it now. And I don't remember much about listening to it. I remember a couple of the songs on the record. I remember I was working in a record store, ding ding, when this came out, and I remember playing it in the store. But apart from a couple of tracks, you know, there wasn't a whole lot that really stuck with me, at least at that time. I think I was probably more interested in going back and listening to the early 70s Lou at that point. But
yeah,
the original Rapper is a song that's on this record that, you know, may not be one that was the most successful of all time. I remember the video being pretty bad.
And that was that the one? It was a time lapse.
Yes.
Yeah, time lapse photography.
That's
yeah.
Right.
Was that a single then,
I think
too?
That was the single, yeah. And it was definitely in that time where you needed to put a single out with a video accompaniment, right? And
got it.
Because his other video had done, you know, like we said, had gotten a little bit of airplay on MTV. Yeah. And
I Love You, Suzanne.
Yeah,
right.
That's right. Yeah. And this one, not so much. And Lou was wearing a bad hat in it, I remember, too.
You know, after coming back and listening to this, like, I don't hate that song. I think it's fine.
Yeah.
But again, it's definitely another one of those, like, kind of throwaway. And, you know, it's a 44-year-old white dude,
that's right,
you know, New York Jewish guy trying to rap about, like, making sure the candy's in the original Rapper. So it's definitely, it's kind of a fun listen, but yeah, it's kind of a throwaway.
It is. Yeah, it is.
I think my favorite is probably No Money Down.
Uh-huh.
I think that's a pretty decent song, even though that one is just full of programmed drums. And I think that one would really have been a lot better had it been, you know, with a full band and just forget about what was happening during the time. Go back to what was happening with you were doing in 1984.
That's right.
You know, we mentioned that there might have been a through line to something we talked about with Neil Young, and this is Lou's Landing on Water.
That's right.
Which is not a great album. I did talk it up a little bit on my 80s Neil, and I don't think it's as bad as what people say it is. At least it isn't to me. I would say the same thing about this. It's not as bad as people say it is, but it's not obviously one of his best albums,
yeah,
in my opinion.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I'm kind of partial to No Money Down as well. I think that's good. I like Video Violence and yeah. Probably Tell It to Your Heart. The two ending songs of The Sides, when I listened to it recently, were the ones that to me sounded pretty good. Yeah. It's interesting that Fernando Sanders produced this album too. He co-produced it with Lou.
Correct.
So that's
it's kind of strange that they would go with this, you know, mid-80s like production style, since he was with him through the last three albums that were all incredible and they sounded great and they weren't like trying to do what everyone else was doing.
Right.
So I'm not sure exactly what happened. Maybe he, again, this might be the only one of these six that I think Lou was maybe trying to cash in on, you know, what was happening and maybe wanting to kind of make a little bit of money, you know, writing more pop based songs or hard rock pop based songs, and doing what everyone else was doing. You know, 'cause historically he was never really very, you know, he didn't sell a lot of records.
No.
Even during his, you know, highest, you know, critical phases, he wasn't really a very well, you know, sold artist. Like he was kind of like a fringe artist. I think he's probably more popular now than he was back in the 70s and 80s.
That is a great point, Scott. And it's important, I think, to remember, too, that at this time, the Velvet Underground was a cult band, but there had not been a big series of reissues of those records. That would come in the, you know, I think it was 86 or something when they started that big reissue program and they put out that box set and all that stuff started happening. But they were just sort of, you know, he was way more well known for Walk on the Wild Side and working with Bowie than he was with, you know, for probably for the Velvet stuff, at least. You know, there were people, like I said, there were cult people that were into the Velvet Underground, but obviously that changed near the end of the decade and in the 90s. But it, like you said, I think you said it just right. I think it's not a bad record at all, but it's just not, it's like, it's not a great Lou album, you know,
correct.
But and there are some that are kind of in that pile, so.
Yeah, I mean, I would put this up there with probably like Sally Can't Dance, and you know, it's not one of the ones that I go back to. This is also one that I bought for $250, and I think I probably paid about what I should have.
It's about right. Yeah, that's about what it's worth.
I think New Sensations and the Blue Mask for $250. I got a steal on those. I think Mistrial, you'll find this in the $2 or $3 bin.
Yeah.
In probably a ton of record stores.
And I think comparing it to Sally Can't Dance is great. Is a great comparison, because kind of if you look at that 70s period, that's kind of the one where it's like, well, yeah, it's not bad, but you know, there's not a whole lot, you know, that makes it completely stand out. And it's kind of similar to Mistrial, you know, kind of middle late part of the decade when it came out. So yeah, I think that's a really good comparison.
Yeah, so you know, I mentioned before the first three we talked about, there was an arc where it went from kind of like, you know, not that great to really great, and then it kind of took a little bit of a dip. Even though I really like Legendary Hearts, I think the production kind of caused that to suffer a little bit, and then it went back up with New Sensations.
Yep.
But then started going down here with Mistrial, where after Mistrial, it was 3 years between Mistrial and his next album.
Mm-hmm.
And the next album that came out was 1989's New York. And this is where you see that line just shoot through the roof. It's such an amazing, incredible album from beginning to end.
It really is.
It's a 57-minute, like musical almost. It's not really a musical, but it's hard to even describe. It's like a book, like a rock song book almost. It's awesome. I love it. It almost, I can almost like picture this being done as a graphic novel.
Yes.
a graphic novel set to music. So like maybe an animated in black and white, like where all of these scenes are happening and you just kind of dive into a scene and then you go back out and you dive back into another scene and it all takes place in New York. And, you know, again, it's not all about New York because he's pretty critical about people that are outside of New York.
Yeah.
But it's just an awesome record. And I really would love if somebody would do something, you know, like that, like a, you know, a cartoon to New York. I love it.
There's a downtown fairy singing out Proud Mary as she cruises Christopher Street. And some southern queen is acting loud and mean where the docks and the badlands meet. This Halloween is something to be sure of. Especially to be here without you. There's a Greta Garbo and an Alfred Hitchcock and some black Jamaican stud. There's five Cinderellas and some leather drags. I almost fell into my mug. There's a Crawford Davis and a tacky Cary Grant. And some homeboys looking for trouble down here from the Bronx. But there ain't no Harry and no Virgin Mary. You won't hear those voices again. And Johnny Rio and Rotten Rita, you never see those faces again. This Halloween is something to be sure of, especially to be here without you. There's the Born Again Losers and the Lavender Boozers and some crack team from Washington Heights. The boys from Avenue B, the girls from Avenue D, a Tinkerbell and tights. This celebration somehow gets me down. Especially when I see you're not around.
It's so, so good. And I think what you hit on there is fantastic. I mean, to me, it's the most poetic of probably the solo
Correct.
Albums, right, that Lou has put out. Maybe the one, at least to me, that seems like where he worked on the lyrics the hardest. And
exactly.
And put all that kind of stuff in there. And I mean, when you look at all the people that get mentioned in this record,
I know.
It's really kind of crazy.
I know it is.
It is,
especially in the light of what's happened over the last 6 years or so.
Yeah.
You've got, you know, people that he's brought back. You know that this was in '89, and he's like crap on people. You know, we won't mention it, but yeah, just go ahead and listen to New York, and you'll hear the people that he's talking about.
It feels like in many ways it was kind of like the album he was eventually going to make. You know, at one point he was always destined to make this record, and it was universally acclaimed critically too.
Oh, yeah,
you know,
well, I think it's only his second gold record.
Yeah, isn't
in
that
his
amazing?
Entire solo career.
Yeah.
So again, he didn't sell very many. So he, I think, gold is what, 500,000 copies.
Yep.
So I don't think it ever went platinum. So yeah, so he sold 500,000 plus probably in the U.S. Worldwide, he probably only, it looks like he only sold about less than a million worldwide, which is just absurd.
It's kind of absurd. It really is. And there,
especially at the time in 1989, people, you still had to buy albums or cassettes. And, you know, at that point, CDs had come out. But, you know, you would think that this one, with the as much critical acclaim as it got,
mm-hmm.
you would think that it might have sold a little bit better than that. But
I agree. And, you know, Dirty Boulevard was a song that got some airplay. And just reading here on Wikipedia,
yeah.
it says it was on Billboard's Modern Rock, or number one on that. But
right. Which, you know, you listen to that song, and when you listen to it, it seems kind of happy.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
It's not like in a super low key, but if you go, if you dig into the lyrics, it's about a poor Hispanic kid,
yep.
or, you know, I'm assuming Hispanic, his name is Pedro, living in like a slum hotel with no windows, knowing that he's going to basically be out on the street selling drugs,
yep.
on the street doing something that he shouldn't be doing because he has no hope in life.
Right.
And that every single song almost on this album talks about things like that. Also, what is it? Track Track one is Romeo Had Juliet, yeah. So it's like a it's almost like, you know, West Side Story type of a thing. Halloween Parade is heartbreaking.
Yeah, it is,
because this was basically, you know, deep in the AIDS epidemic, and you know, the song is talking about, you know, I'm at the Halloween Parade this year, and so and so's not here, and so and so's not here, and just so on and so on. Endless Cycle is basically about the endless cycle of, you know, parents mistreating their children,
yeah,
and then their children mistreating their children. And it's, I don't know, I love it. Last Great American Whale is an awesome song. There's not really, I don't think, one bad song on this entire album.
I don't either. It really is a cycle that holds up because all the links of the chain are strong. And I mean, just like you were saying about Dirty Boulevard, I mean, think of a song like Busload of Faith. It just starts off with, like, you can't depend on this, you can't depend on that, you can't depend on anything except for your faith, and you need so much of it, like, to fill up a bus to even survive day to day in New York.
And it's kind of crazy. A lot of these songs are still relevant today.
Yes.
Like Straw Man talking about, do we need another million, you know, another, rich superstar, rich movie star? Do we need another rock singer that is, you know, coming out and, like, saying all this stuff? Do we need any of this stuff? Do we need the government to control everything? Like, it's still relevant.
This was
from 1989.
I know.
It's crazy.
You read news stories today, and you could go into the comments and post a quote from this album, and it would be so relevant, and it would make more sense than, you know, rambling on about how you feel, because it was like, hey, Lou saw this back in 1989, you know, it was right there in front of him, and he sees through to the soul of the city in this album. And it also, you know, coming off of Mistrial, he stripped back again, right? He's got the guitars, you know, like he did on the Blue Mask, one in each channel. He's got Fred Mayer on drums. Mo Tucker from the Velvet Underground actually plays on a couple tracks.
Two songs. Yeah, she's on Last Great American Whale, which, again, is a highlight song for me.
Yeah, that. And then you've got a bass player, and that's
exactly,
other than a few backing vocals here and there, that's it. And Lou, you know, is did a lot of the production and mixing on the record, too, and it's interesting, you know, I think there was a deluxe issue that came out at some point, and it had a lot of, I remember listening to it at one point. I'm not a big fan of those kind of deluxe reissues of albums that I really like, but there was a lot of, you know, like, demo versions of these songs, showing that I think a lot of work went into the way he wanted to get them right, especially with the way he was going to put the words together with the music and the way he was going to sing, you know, quote unquote, sing
right.
His original rapper style. But it all came together like in a perfect way. It really, there's not much you would change about it if you could go back and and alter it. Yeah.
I need to listen to that. I'm also not a fan of.
Yeah, it just kind of ruins it for me.
Deluxe reissues. Yeah. Exactly. I want the album the way the album was originally released.
Yep.
And I was fortunate enough to find this. They did release it as a single double LP. You didn't have to buy the big Mondo box. So I did purchase this sometime last year. I think it was at Barnes & Noble, everybody. Barnes & Noble. I would love to hear the rough mixes and the work tapes, because it doesn't sound overproduced. But
no.
It would be fascinating to listen to him say, I'm going to do it this way and let's do this. It's very minimalist. The only song that's like a real rocker is also the only one that I don't think is very relevant to today, and that's Good Evening, Mr. Waldheim.
Uh-huh.
Lyrically speaking, it's kind of like, it's back in the late 80s. It talks about Jesse Jackson, and it doesn't really have a very good message. You know, I don't think he would have written the same lyrics today if he were writing it. Anyway, that's a pretty, you know, pretty rocking song. The rest of it is really mellow and kind of laid back. It would be interesting to hear some of those rough mixes. I'll have to look into that.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff, and it's unclear whether or not he made a whole set of acoustic demos for this one, or you know how they all actually came about. But I think you're right. That's a really good point about Good Evening, Mr. Waldheim. He probably would not have been so direct, and specific to a time frame as he was. If he did it again, and a lot of it isn't that way, like you were saying, they're just sort of characters or people that represent what's happening in the city and how he saw it, and depressing at times, but a accurate portrait of humanity,
exactly
as much as you could ever get, I would say.
I agree. Yeah, it's really great. Again, I do think I like Blue Mask, and I go back to Blue Mask more. But I think that kind of goes back to my roots in 90s grunge and 90s alternative music, because that's kind of, you know, always been there for me since then. But this is, it's his masterpiece, at least one of his masterpieces, with Transformer probably being another one, and then again I've mentioned Berlin, so I think those three plus the Blue Mask, if you take all four of those albums, I mean, there are artists that would have killed to have one of those.
Absolutely.
And Blue had four
and know.
Had two of them back to back with Transformer and Berlin, and then another two within 7 years of each other in the 80s.
Amazing. And all that to say, that was, you know, 10 plus years after those first two,
exactly,
that he would come back and be able to put something together that was so strong after such a long time. And it's interesting after this, because this, I mean, it really feels to me like it closes a certain chapter in Lou's work and the stuff he did. You know, Andy Warhol died, and then he did Songs for Drella with Cale, and then the Velvets got back together, and then it was a whole kind of a different thing after that.
Which, if the Velvets would have gotten back together in like the early 2000s, I think it would have been huge.
Yep, I agree.
But I think they got together a little bit. They got back together a little bit too soon, and it kind of fell flat, and it just kind of fizzled out. By the early 2000s, you know, the Velvet Underground, they were like this huge, massive band that all of these people that are my age or your age and even younger were like, yes, I want that. And then they were nowhere to be found at that point.
Right, exactly. That's really well said. Yeah, the timing of that was not good. No.
Yeah, in 93, a lot of the people that like them now were too young to even, you know, appreciate what they missed out on.
Right.
Pretty much.
Right, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, just touring in Europe or playing big festivals over there instead of when they should have been probably reforming and playing in the United States in the 2000s, that would have been the right way to do it. Yeah. And, you know, it's interesting too that should just note that I don't think, at least in this case, makes a whole lot of difference. Not maybe the way that the switch from Arista to RCA did, because he was coming back to RCA, which was kind of his first label, but he switched over to Sire Records for New York. And I do think that the promotion of this album, the fact that Lou was out there doing interviews and, you know, was touring, did a lot of touring behind this record and all that really helped it become the success that it was. It deserved that kind of attention from the label that maybe he hadn't always gotten from other labels.
Yeah, I mean, I was 15 when this came out. I was 15, almost 15. It came out January 10th of 89, so almost 15. And I remember hearing Dirty Boulevard all over the place.
Yes.
It was all over.
Yeah, it was.
I didn't really even know. I mean, I probably had known who Lou Reed was at that point, but it wasn't like a band or an artist that I would have really been listening to at that point.
Yeah.
But it was all over the place. So I agree. I think the backing he had on this was what made it as popular as it was, and deservedly so. It was definitely worth that. You know, unlike other bands like Big Star that never had the backing and, you know, stuff like that, at least. Not comparing the two, because obviously Big Star was a newer band at that point, but yes, sometimes you have to have that push behind somebody and something to get people to listen to it.
Yeah, and I think it did wonders for Lou's career from then on, and allowed him a lot of freedom to sort of do different things. I mean, he did all kinds of interesting things, you know, for the rest of his career, even though we won't mention that Metallica album anyway.
you read some, you know, stuff about that, and people are thinking that might end up being looked at as a classic record at some point in the future.
Yeah.
And, you know, and people always crap on Metal Machine Music, and I had never listened to it until last night. And I'm going to tell you what, I'm going to go back to it. I didn't listen to the whole thing. I don't know anybody that probably listened to the whole thing.
No, maybe Lester Bangs was the only one that listened to the whole thing.
So, you know, who knows? Maybe Lulu will one of these days be a classic that people will enjoy.
It might be. So. It might be. We'll have to... all right. This has been fantastic, Scott. Thank you so much. I want to...
No problem. Thank you. I appreciate
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. It's always a pleasure to have you on, and I know that we're have tossed around a couple other ideas for these.
Yeah.
I do want to tell people while we were talking, I looked it up, and you go back to episode 958, folks. We pulled it off in one episode, Neil Young in the 80s. It was published back in October of 2020, so there are a lot of tracks and a lot of talking, so go listen to that.
It's a marathon.
958, you're going to do it. Save it for your next long jog or car ride, but you'll definitely want to hear it if you have not. It's great. And you can also go to suburbspie.com. You can type in the search bar for the Kinks, and you'll see the episodes that Scott and I did about those periods as well. Any closing thoughts, Scott?
I don't think so. I just hope people go back and listen to some Lou Reed, especially ones that maybe you'd never heard, because you might be missing something that you didn't even realize that you would love. So, I would go back to listen to Blue Mask. If you've never heard the Blue Mask and you consider yourself a music fan, you are doing yourself a disservice by not listening to that record.
A great disservice. I will absolutely agree with you. And keep your eyes peeled, folks, next time you're flipping through the record bins for those Lou Reed 80s solo albums, because you'll probably come across them if you keep a sharp eye out. So you definitely want to add those when you can. And Scott's going to pick up a couple he needs as well. So
yeah, for sure.
I don't have Mistrial, so I'll have to see where I can pick that up. Anyway, folks, if you have anything to say about 80s Lou Reed, please get in touch. We'd love to hear what your thoughts are out there. You can send an email to rock@suburbspod.com. You can find us on social media. We're at Suburbs Pod all over the place, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. And you can actually call, and I actually have it here. We have a Suburban Party line that you can call and leave a message. It's very easy if you're driving around and you have a thought. Just dial
612-440-1984.
Stick your head out the window and yell, and somebody will come and tell you that Suburbs Pod needs you or something like that. Anyway, Mr. Scott Parks, thank you so much. It's always a pleasure to have you.
Same.
I am Patrick Foster.
I'm Scott Parks.
And we will talk to you guys tomorrow.
They say he didn't have an enemy. His was a greatness to behold. He was the last surviving progeny, the last one on this side of the world. He measured a half mile from tip to tail, silver and black, with powerful fins. They say he could split a mountain in two. That's how he got the Grand Canyon. Last great American whale. last great American whale. Last great American whale. Last great American whale. Some say they saw him at the Great Lakes. Some say they saw him off of Florida. My mother said she saw him in Chinatown. But you can't always trust your mother. Off the Carolinas, the sun shines brightly in the day. The lighthouse glows ghostly there at night. The chief of a local tribe had killed a racist mayor's son. He'd been on death row since 1958. The mayor's kid was a rowdy pig. Spit on Indians and lots worse. The old chief buried a hatchet in his head. Life compared to death for him seemed worse. The tribal brothers gathered in the lighthouse to sing and tried to conjure up a storm or rain. The harbor parted.
Yesterday we talked about the first three records that Neil Young put out.
Lou Reed.
Jeez.